So if you take your books, and I'm a big believer in you never having to write any notes at a retreat. So I wrote it all out for you. I wrote it out three times. So everything I'm going to say is already written in that give me an authentic voice. It's then in an outline, and then I even put in the PowerPoint slides you're going to see. So you can just sit back and relax. And so I suggest page 21 is the outline we're going to go through, and the slides are after that. And so in this brief time this morning, you're going to learn more about Psalms than most pastors know, and be able, when I'm done, to know the types of Psalms, how to outline them quickly, how to get into it, into its context, and how to apply it in your life. There's just some simple grids and structures that will help you dive in. So I'm going to give you that. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll do Psalm 142, David's voice. So, Mr. Slide Man, next one. Oh, back. So, starting off, who's who in the Psalms? And I can't overemphasize this point. The Psalms, the original author of the Psalm is so important, as you know, is David, right? So you all assume that because you guys are from Idaho, but where we are in California, that's not assumed. Most scholars today, including evangelical scholars, don't take David's authorship seriously. They just think it's a poet, it was written for David, and so you lose the entire context of Samuel that feeds the Psalms, and you lose the theology that he's the king. The primary author of the Psalms is Israel's king, which means that's the Messiah. David's the author of 73 individual poems, and it's his role, what he's trying to do, is to, as Israel's king, to further God's kingdom, both in breadth among the nations and in depth within the heart of God's people. And next slide, you can see Psalm 2 is the king's coronation. And in 2 Samuel 7, when David wanted to build God's house, God says, you're not going to build a house for me, I'm going to build a house for you. And it's going to be a house of sons. And each of those sons all adopt into a father-son relationship with me, and that the way that they spread God's kingdom on earth is through this gift of prayer. So the title God's Son doesn't mean God Junior. It originally meant God's Messianic King, who's Israel's representative in prayer to further God's rule on the earth. And that temple was just to be a house of prayer. And so he's invited at his coronation. He just says, ask of me and I'll give you the nations. So notice, not just Israel. This king is going to be Lord of the whole earth, and the whole land is going to be holy. All right, next slide. So growing up, you know, David did not really have a voice. And you can just see this, that he learned to pray and to write on his harp. And you can see here this wonderful little wordplay. Your wanderings you have recorded. You put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your record? So the Hebrew word wanderings, node, is the same, close to the word bottle. And then the word recorded is the verb, safar, and then the same word for book, sifra. It's this beautiful little line. So he knew, even though he didn't have a voice in his family, that as his tears went down, God recorded every drop in his scroll, kept his memory alive. He had that sense. That's what rejection does for you. Okay, next slide. So, three main types of Psalms, and these account for 100 of the 150 Psalms. So David appoints the Levites, and he tells them to write three kinds of Psalms. The first is to make petition or invoke, to thank, and to praise the Lord. That last word, halal, is where we get the word Psalms, the tahalim, the praises. Every single psalm, even all the laments, have praise in them except one, Psalm 88. That's the black sheep of the Psalter. So three types of psalms are lament, comes from the Hebrew word zakar, which means to remember, and it's causative, so it means to cause God to remember me in my need. What starts this prayer out, is not us, however, though. It's because God anointed David as king, poured that oil over his head, gave him the prophetic word, gave him the charismatic victory over Goliath to say, you're the messianic king. Because of that, God has a legal obligation to save him. It's a covenant relationship. David has a legal obligation to cry out. So it's not just Calvinistic fatalism, whatever happens, happens. David is to cry out in oppression. He has that obligation to cry out. God has a legal obligation to save him. So it starts the Psalms going is these laments. And so lament is basically giving grief a voice. Then God answers his prayer to maintain covenant loyalty. He has to. And when that happens, David is under obligation to come back to the temple area or congregational worship and write a poem of thanksgiving to share with the congregation how God saved the messianic king. Not to do that is sin. So, and then David says he so looks forward to doing that, it becomes his life purpose of paying his vows to God of doing this. It's a wonderful gift. Then praise, halal, is just pure raving about the character of God. And you don't really get these until Psalm 145, one, that the whole earth praise God, all the instruments, all creation. It's funny. I'm sure every church has this issue. Sometimes the old people don't like the instruments that young people use, you know, in worship. And I remember one time this old guy comes in and he saw drums on the stage and he about had a fit. And he complained to me. So I was up preaching. I had the last word. I said, there aren't enough instruments in this entire universe to give praise to God. The trees are going to clap their hands and everything. He left the church. Anyway. So, next slide. Now, what starts these Psalms moving is David has made promises. He's the messianic king. So, as messianic king, God's Spirit's on him. All of God's people are to come to him for advice and justice. They're to look after him. He's to have a right-hand man. But then life happens, and you step off the stage from that coronation. You step off into life, and David spends 13 years in a wilderness where there is no physical evidence that these promises are true. And it creates what we call tension. And tension leads to disorientation, where the old orders or the equations you're working with don't work, they don't function, you feel displaced, dismayed, distraught. Sometimes, at the worst, you feel even betrayed or abandoned. That's the most difficult emotion to experience, is abandonment. So, next slide. What do we do when we experience tension? So here's the common reactions to disorientation that we do in the church. First is denial. It didn't happen. And the reason why you can't articulate it or even go there is it threatens your faith or whatever equation of faith you have. You just can't take in the new reality. So it didn't happen. Deny it. Or you make mention of the pain, but you move quickly to praise to avoid embracing the pain. Often when people are in a lot of pain, whether it's a divorce or cancer or unemployment or, you know, just addiction, they're a threat to Joe Christian. So if he comes up in church and you realize he's still in all this pain and there's no resolve, you feel threatened by that. So you just say, well, God bless you. God works all things together for good to those who love God. And so he'll heal you eventually. And so you move quickly to praise and the person never is allowed to articulate all the tensions. So that's what you do. Now, after you do that for 10, 20, 30 years, you finally have had it up to here. So you finally do what a lot of us do. You call a counselor and you vent 20 years of tensions with the counselor at $150 an hour. And I love counselors. I brought one with me. But you never do it in worship and you never integrate it in your life so that everybody else knows you. And so it's all done in isolation. So I'm going to save you a lot of money. There's a lot cheaper way to do this that the ancients did. Next slide. So when David was disoriented, he writes a psalm of lament. And when he does, the lament itself, what I liked about the Psalms, you know, as Paul says, pray without ceasing. How do I do? When I get up in the morning and I pray, I'm a blank. Seriously. I'm a pastor. I'm supposed to get paid to pray. I can pray great at church, but when I'm alone, to be honest with you, I don't know what to say in the morning, and I'm not doing it very good orally. So then I found in the Psalms, each psalm articulates just one tension. I go, whoa, I can do that. That's not too difficult for a guy with ADD. And so with David, he has freedom to boldly confront God. I like the Psalms because you don't have to use a lot of words. Just, hey, you. That's intimate speech. And he articulates whatever tensions in his soul. The language it uses is metaphors, because metaphors create new ideas, new ways of speaking. When you use them too much, they become trite and they lose their impact. But it's easy to invent new ones. And so he's always inventing new ways to describe tension. If you can articulate something inside you, you can rule it. God's gift to us as human beings is speech. That's why man names everything. God named everything in Genesis 1. He gives speech to Adam in Genesis 2. Adam names all the animals. And when you can name it, you can control it. Do you ever notice the current generation, when they're frustrated, they only have two words, F you. And then, because that doesn't suffice, it gets banal after a while. What do? It's violence. Why are they violent? It's because they can't articulate what's inside them, and they're not validated. So it's just F you, and then the guns come out, or whatever. And I think we're a violent generation because we're an inarticulate generation, because we don't know how to talk in worship. So worship ought to be the place where we articulate and process all our emotions. And that's what David does. So, next slide. Now, talk about tension. Now, if we just start the Psalter, and you want to go through the Psalter chronologically, Psalm 1 and 2 are the introduction. So Psalm 1 talks about the blessed person who loves Torah. He puts it in his heart. He's like this tree planted by streams of water. So it gets you on course to take the Scriptures, memorize them, and love them. Psalm 2 is our commission, invited as God's sons to pray. How do you bring heaven to earth when the nations are all upset? Pray, ask me. All right, well then, let's just step off into real life. What happens? God is so interesting. You'd think if he's going to teach us how to pray, it'd be like Sesame Street. You know, today's the letter A. We're just in arithmetic. It's just 1 + 1 = 2. And then in a year, we'll learn algebra. And then we'll do geometry later. And finally, we'll get into calculus, where things get wild and there's variables and dx and Newtonian physics. And then Einstein's, it's all relative. So you wonder, how does this work? Psalm 3. How to connect with God and pray when your son hates your guts because you're an adulterer and a murderer, and he's doing the same thing, and you have no basis to discipline him, and he's created a military coup against you. I mean, that's graduate school. How do you have a voice with God with that? It struck me, it's kind of like, will this covenant hold after you committed murder and adultery? So we're sort of asked to, you know those bungee jumps? You go to this large canyon. I think Australia and New Zealand have the biggest ones. And you step and you look down this canyon at how many hundreds of feet. And here's the Messiah. And he says, all right, strap yourself to him because you're going off the cliff. And you're going to jump and you're going to see if this thing holds you. So you go down, you know, past the darkness of Bathsheba. And then the killing Uriah. And then the sun's revolt. And you're wondering, is it going to hold? Is it going to hold? And God's covenant holds. That's the first poem you're supposed to learn. Incredible. And then the next one, his cabinet. He prays for rain, and rain doesn't happen. So they go, you're not the Messianic king. And his apostate cabinet goes off into Baal worship. He loses his cabinet. Psalm 5, he's surrounded by lies around him every side. And Psalm 6, he's got these traitors that want him dead because he's sick because of discipline. And he's almost dead, and now, but his enemies go, well, you're not the king. Next slide. So, I mean, talk about tension. Now, you won't have to face all, I don't think you're going to have to face a war in your, well, sometimes you do with people, you get wars in your families. Drought, the rebels, sickness. So David gives a voice. Incredible how he learns to not just articulate, but so grab hold of God that there's healing that happens and life happens in the midst of these tensions. So if you don't like tension, don't read the Bible. Next slide. Now, the lament, the voice of lament, these are the little motifs that are in the psalm, not always in this order. So you can go through every lament psalm. You can always tell when you're in one because it always starts with, "Oh Lord," direct address. And then in the lament, he details his lament. And then he gives a petition, usually based on God's loyal love or the enemy's too strong. And then he makes a vow. Now, all the vow is, I've done my legal obligation to pray. You're under legal obligation to save me. When you do, I will pay my vows to the congregation to tell the congregation how you did it. A church that does not have body life is a dead church. That's why I'm all for transfer. If I don't know how God's saving you guys, if the pulpit's just going this way and it's all information, and we don't hear where God is saving here and here, rescuing his sons, we're a dead church. But you know what it's like when people share it about, you know, and forget the preacher. We don't remember a thing he said, but here was this, God's alive when people are sharing and articulate, paying their vows. It's wonderful. Now, here's the neatest thing about lament poetry. This is what's going to happen to you this weekend. I don't know how this happens. It's mysterious. The German scholars don't get it. They think, you know, when you get confidence sections, it's a different psalm. When you articulate tension in worship in front of your family, God gives you an insight, such that you go up the mountain a little further. It's not a huge insight. It's not like a charismatic elevator that takes you to the top of the mountain and you're waving your hands. But it's an insight into perspective. And this is when David goes, "But God." And he feels the faith that he knew here all of a sudden went here, as he was honestly to say, "I think you abandoned me." But then he goes, "But you." And he rehearses something, and God gives him an insight. And some of these insights are so great. It's as if his spirit is transported into the future to taste the salvation before it comes in history, before he's saved. Because at the end of the psalm, the circumstances are the same. But sometimes he's so different by the end of the poem that, like, he's just praising because he's experiencing it before it happens. Now, that's the gift of lament. And this is how your paradigms start to change. And then sometimes he has the assurance of being heard. So those are the things. If you know those, you can read any psalm of lament and say, okay, here's the petition, here's the lament, here's the confidence, here's the vow. Boom. You can outline them. 5 minutes. Okay, next psalm. Next slide. So here's sort of the order. Life begins with disorientation. Many laments, petitions, vow, and then I love this. This little insight happens. He's delivered, and then thanksgiving and praise, where he's totally reoriented. Next slide. Now, when he's reoriented, it's huge. When God answers prayers, did you ever notice? He never does the same way twice. Nobody's life. You can't make a model of this and say this is how life's going to happen from a linear perspective. But it's like, it's a wonder. The Hebrew word nephalah is something so out of this world, only God can do it. The Exodus is a wonder. It's a nephalah. And every time God saves David out of a cave or out of this, it's a nephalah. It's just a wonder. He's just totally reoriented. It's a new creation not expected, a new orientation, a new coherence that holds life together, a new covenant, surprising awe. He fulfills his vows, and that becomes his life purpose, is to fulfill his vows in doxology. Okay, next slide. So, the voice of praise. Next slide. Now, here's what happens in reorientation. And I want your worship leaders to listen. This is how you're going to write your new songs. When he gets reoriented, he gets new definitions for theological ideas. So in Psalm 73, the word good, tov, means when God is good to you in the Old Covenant, it meant you're obedient. God fulfills your covenant, which means you get your rain, you get your crops, your cattle are fertile, your wife's fertile, you have a lot of kids, you're blessed with life. So the psalmist observes life, and he thinks the wicked get what is good, and he lost what is good, and he was obedient, and that creates disorientation. It's a very common disorientation in the Christian life. How come? I'm amazed in Silicon Valley. Do you know the idiots we have as CEOs? And I don't know, I mean, these guys are abusive. They're like little Nazis. It's their own little, I go, how did they get there? And then the guys lower, they all get critiqued and managed. And if they act that way, you know, you're out. But nobody challenges the top guys. And then the company go down the drains and then they make millions and everybody, I just don't get that. And so right? The wicked get what's good and their kids go to the right colleges and we lose what is good and we're unemployed. So that's disorientation. So next slide. So the psalmist, he has a very long lament in Psalm 73, but I've only quoted a little bit of it. He says, when I pondered this, it was so troublesome to me, and he articulates it to the nth degree. And then he says, I came to the temple. Now, in those days, the temple was not the real temple. It was a psychological gateway using your five senses, your eye gate, your ear gate, what you heard, the smell of the incense, to take you psychologically into the heavenly temple. So he was worshiping. And when he got to that temple, he went, oh, I see their end. And so he comes to this insight. So here's his new insight that he didn't have before. The good of the wicked is only temporary. The psalmist lost what was good, but in the process he gained God. That works in English because you just change one O. And he goes, that's better. A better inheritance. So now he's going to redefine the word tov, good. But as for me, the nearness of my God is my good. Just, that's a whole new definition. So we went through this psalm, we come to a new definition, and we go, ah. Now, when we have a praise chorus that goes, God is so good, he's so good to me. It means nothing when we sing it. So because it doesn't mean anything, we just keep repeating it. But it doesn't have any content. And it doesn't make this wonderful change from arithmetic to calculus, where it's invested with new meaning. And so there's not a lot of emotion you have in that when you just sing that idea. It's a concept, but there's no guts in it. So I'm all for singing the guts. Other than that, I've got no opinion. Okay, next slide. Now, your life of faith is living between these extremes. This disorientation doesn't happen once. It happens your whole life. And you think you're going to get old and retire, and, you know, it's going to be great. I tell you, there's more disorientation with your health, disorientation with kids, adult children, puts you over the edge. And this is the life of faith. We just come to events we can't control, and we learn to keep trusting God till we die, until finally we put the body in the grave for the ultimate disorientation, and then we are raised from the dead. So this should help you realize your journey. So that's how we should encourage each other. Now, next slide. The application of the Psalms. Because David's the king, he writes 73 of these poems. Other psalms were written for the king or about the future king coming. He gives voice to his own life. That voice shapes the voice of all future kings. Now think of this. David is a human being, and he teaches Jesus how to pray, who's God. Become man, became flesh. But he gives up his deity. David gives Christ a voice. And the reason we don't have Jesus' prayers recorded is because they are recorded. He prayed the Psalms. So if you want to know the soul of Jesus, what went on the inside of him, apart from where it confesses sin, you just go to the Psalter. And you know exactly what he prayed. And so next slide, you'll see on the cross, he quotes four different psalms. And when he quotes a line of it, the Jews all had these memorized. In fact, you know, you couldn't be a Benedictine monk unless you memorized the Psalter. That was your ordination. So you know what happened. Jerome first made his first edition of the Psalms before he had languages. Then he learned Greek, and he did this new version off the Septuagint, the Greek version. So the monks had to learn it all over again. Well, now we know that the Vulgate, the only book that does not come from the Hebrew text, is the Psalms. You know why? Jerome learned Hebrew, and he did a third version, and the monks put their foot down. We're not going to learn another translation of the Psalms. So the Vulgate goes off the Greek version of the translation. But when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me on the cross? We think that's what they call the cry of dereliction. That's not the cry of dereliction. He's thinking the whole poem. And the end of that poem is he gets a vision of the whole nations gathered at the foot of the cross, the rich, the young, and the poor are all going to feast because it is done. And his last word, of course, on the cross is, it is finished. So that was his cry of hope through lament. So it shapes Christ's voice. Okay, next slide. Now, here's how you can make the application. These psalms are not some arbitrary poet praying because his boss hates him at work. They are about God's messianic king trying to further God's rule on earth, both in breadth and depth. Christ is that king, and you're in Christ. So, these are your prayers. Why would you go anywhere else to learn how to pray? To learn how to talk to God? To learn how to voice worship? We're having our worship pastor now. He's rewriting them to make it more singable for the congregation. Slowly, it takes work. But they have a lot of chant versions of the Psalms that are just kind of pedantic. But, you know, the early church memorized this book. Okay, next slide. So, don't get after me for making you write poetry, because Paul commands it. Ha ha. So, he says, be filled with the Spirit. And that doesn't mean get more of it. That means let the Spirit in you play ra'o. Fill it out. It's like you tell a choir, sing. And when you sing, I can put holiness in the air instantly by singing the Psalms. And then the hymns and spiritual songs. So in Paul's day, what this was, the Psalms were Israel's Psalter. And then hymns were the new material they were writing, the spiritual songs. And then he expected new songs to happen as new acts of salvation happen in every congregation. So I would take this verse and say, the congregation ought to speak and sing the Psalms. We ought to sing the historic hymns of the church and not lose that material. And we ought to be writing new music because God keeps saving us. And so your church ought to have a sense that some songs come from this person here in a certain situation. And now we take it upon ourselves, we give praise together. And every time you sing it, it has layers of memory and history. Okay, next slide. So, do you have a voice? Next slide. So you buy a blank book, and you write in it the first book of Psalms by Jackson Kramer, begun January 2012, but he's a good student, he learned it much earlier. Next one. Then, let David be your voice and add your own. So, like Tevye's, would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I had just a small fortune? Anyway, next slide. So this is what I did, and this is my prayer journal. I was at Psalm 73 that day, and it happened to be Jessica's birthday. And when it says, but as for me, the nearness of God is my good. And so that phrase hit me, and I said, oh, daughter Jessica, I know these verses mean more to you than to me, than your father. For 22 years, you've sat beneath his throne, naively near, with no false gods warring in your soul, while your mother and I simply wait to be made like you. That was my prayer that day. Very simple. Okay, next slide. Then, you don't just write these things. You get a stage to share it. And this is when heaven comes to earth. It's an interesting thing about memory. Memory is more powerful than the events, your emotion when the event occurred. When you go back and reflect on an event, like think of all those war veterans, you know, World War II, you know, and they don't talk for years, and you get them to talk. they have more emotion in rehearsing the event than when the event happened. And so the holiness that happens as we share, because I don't think healing happens until we get in the context of community. And the Spirit, you look your brothers and sisters in the eye and they validate you and they're with you and the Holy Spirit's present, and it's just very healing. Okay, Doug Neal, stand up. I want you to read that bottom paragraph, which is the scriptures. 1 Samuel 22, 1 to 5. Page 46.
So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him, and David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know that God will do for what God will do for me." Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. The prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of something.
Herod.
Yeah.
Grazie.
All right. Okay, thank you.
So I wasn't paid to do this, but this is extra. I'm going to give you an extra tip on biblical narrative. Structure is very important. If I find I can know the structure, how a text is put together, I can find meaning. So when God made the heavens and the earth, the first 3 days he made structures, separates, you know, light from darkness, separated water above from water below, then separated earth and land, had boundaries. Then he went back the next 3 days and filled them with life. So it's very important to know the structures of a text. If you know how a text says, you know how a text means. So if you'll notice on the right, there's a little outline. It's a chiastic structure. And a lot of biblical narrative, you know, everybody that writes a movie, you always know you're when you're at the end of a movie. You just know, because you're at the same scene as the beginning, right? And yet everything's been made new through this journey. And so a journey usually starts with a scene, and then there's obstacles and tensions, and there's usually a climax in the movie, then there's a little denouement, then you return to where you were, and there's now things have been made new, or whatever. And people just, I just noticed, do that naturally. Directors didn't go to school on biblical rhetoric. But the Bible just, it's not just how what it says, but how it says it's significant. And, you know, your whole life's a chiastic structure. You know, we start in the dirt and we end in the dirt, you know, with your life in the middle. But so if you, the point of this is the whole turning point is not the end, it's the center. So if you look at this little story, you find in the A's, David escapes to Adullam. And then A prime, he escapes to the forest of Heth because the prophet tells him to leave. Okay, and then on the B, and the B prime is all about David's physical family. They first identify with him, and then he provides for them, taking them to Moab. And this is why he goes to Moab, because Ruth, his ancestor, came from there. He has relatives there. But what's the X of the story? It's the new family that's born in this cave that come to David. And how are they described? Well, they're described as those who are in distress, everyone who's in debt. Saul's kingdom had high tax structures, and everybody's ticked off. And then it says those who are discontented is a lightweight definition. It's bitter of spirit. 400 ragtag guys gathering to him in the cave. Now, stories shape later stories. So here Jesus is praying in this cave, and there's spiritual life in him emanating it that anybody who's spiritual can find him. Saul can't find him with the CIA. So how do these guys find him? You don't know. Well, you roll the history forward, and we find the Prince of Peace. He's born in a very threatening environment. And, you know, the king wants him dead. That king can't find him, but the shepherds find him, and the wise men from the east find the cave, and they all worship there at the cave. The story's repeated. And in essence, this is a story, I think, of our lives, in that you often find your physical family rejects you, and you can't work it, and there's rejection. So what happens? You're forced out, and you find a new family spiritually that becomes your real family, but then that spiritual family then impacts eventually your physical family. And it's just like on a large scale, the gospel goes Jew, Gentile, then what? Jew. If the Gentiles make the Jews jealous. And that's a paradigm that's macro, it's micro. And I was talking to Mick earlier about his daughters. This is what gives parents hope that, you know, when your kids rebel, they go away from you. And yet it isn't you that leads them back, it's other people, and eventually life hopefully comes together. So these structures are very significant, and they give you order in life and a way to negotiate your life and help you to know what's ahead. So they're not random. God's structures shape life, and that's why you've got to be Bible students, live in the material, and see all these stories shaping later stories. So, that was a freebie. Jackson didn't ask me to do that. God bless him. So if you take what I've done here in terms of the shape of David's story, earlier I took you, if you want to go chronologically in the Psalms, that's one way to do it. This, I took the historical superscripts and just put them in historical order, 7 of the 13. And it starts off with the voice in exile, which is this text. How does David have a voice? And then notice it's going to end. How does David have a voice in Psalm 63? He's in exile again. But this exile is different. This exile is one of his own making. So how do you have a voice when you've made your exile after you followed the Lord and you're responsible to put yourself in a wilderness versus just being given a wilderness? And so, and then in 1 Samuel 24, he's cornered by a rebellious king. In Psalm 57, when he's in the cave, B prime. Then he's cornered by another, a would-be king, his son. That's more painful. It's a little more intense. And then C, the voice of grief, we'll look at this afternoon. How do you have a voice when your best friend dies? Jonathan was his right-hand man. So why is it that for me to be king, my best friend has to die? And so every time David put that crown on, he knew that's because Jonathan gave his life. That's moving. How come that has to be? How do you give voice to that? So, but then go to C prime. It's the voice of grief again. David again has to give voice for the death of his friend. But now David's the murderer. How do you do that? So that's David's greatest poem. The reason why he's at the lowest place in his life. He's got nothing to work with. He has to get from the gutter to heaven again. And so he's got to invent metaphors that have never been invented. And we'll look at that tonight. There's 20 different metaphors he uses that become new inventions. Now he becomes the Einstein of grace. He goes places nobody went before. And then in the center is the voice of praise, which is Psalm 18, after he's delivered from Saul and he gives this. And the only language he can use is what you'll find these poets. He's so awestruck by God. How do I tell God you're great? Well, what he does, the greatest event in Israel's history was the Exodus. And he takes the metaphors of the Exodus, you know, that God thundered in the heavens and came down and the earth quaked and fire and smoke. And he says, that's what you did for me. And he uses all those Exodus metaphors to describe what God did for him to save him from 13 years from Saul. That's the only language appropriate he can use. And now the Exodus is personal for him. And that God would do this for me, it's incredible. So, a little bit about the shape of his voice. Ha, look at that. Now, here is David's life in the wilderness. So if you're looking for order in your life, forget it. I'm amazed at kids today. I work with engineers. And it's always like when they're young, my life's going to be linear and I'm going to do this and do this. And then I get my girlfriend and we get married and then we have kids when we're 45 after I bought the house and the cabin and all this stuff. And this is what it ends up being, you know, a disaster, learning to trust God and losing control and in the wilderness. So Adullam is this, if you can see it here, it's that little red deal. So Jackson and I went in search for Adullam, as I shared last night. It was quite an adventure. We found the cave. But I just wanted to show you some slides of some of the area that David had to live in. This is En Gedi. This is the waterfall going up to En Gedi. And there, usually when you go, if you ever go to Israel, the tour bus stops right there at the Dead Sea. And you usually have a choice, because you don't usually have much time, because these guys want to make a lot of money and they're moving you fast. So they either say, you can swim in the Dead Sea, or you can walk a mile or so and go to the waterfall of En Gedi. So let me advise you, the Dead Sea is oily, you put your eyes under it, they'll burn, and you get out, you're all sticky, and usually Israel's hot, forget it. Go to the fresh waters of En Gedi and the waterfall and get some fresh water. So here's Adullam, and the cave is on the backside of that forested hill. And the area is replete with caves. And even when we were there, there was still a sheepfold there from another shepherd who would put the sheep in the fold at night, then he'd lay across the front as the door, just like the parable. And then here, the mighty men of Adullam, when we were young and unafraid and all that stuff. And yeah. Well, yeah, no, but there are other chambers that had closed in. So there were several chambers that went back, and I think you could get 400 in eventually. But it strikes me when you're in this area, you realize David was a shepherd in this area his whole life. No wonder Saul couldn't find him. This was just, it's like David knew all the sheep paths and everything else, and God prepared him as a shepherd. Okay, here's your lesson now in Hebrew poetry. Okay, Austin, read that, the English. Stand up. I hope you're louder than your father, because you don't need a mic. This is a football coach, so he knows how to yell, speak to kids.
David's plea: with my voice to the Lord I cry aloud. With my voice to the Lord I appeal for grace. I pour out before him my complaints. My distress before him I declare. When my spirit fails within me. The bottom right.
What happened? How come my Hebrew fonts aren't showing up? It's my computer. It's not my computer? You put it on your... Big mistake. Well. It goes Kol E, El Adonai, Sa'ak. Gosh, ruined my Hebrew. There's always a compromise in these conferences, aren't there? Yeah. They did the miracles getting this so I could just push these silly little buttons and I lost all the Hebrew. I put the Hebrew up there just so you could see. Every one of those lines is just three words in Hebrew. And the Hebrew poets worked with either 7, 8, or 9 syllables per line. They worked with a highly mathematical structure to be tight. And so each of those is just three words. And the words are, takes three words in English to do one in Hebrew. That's the only reason I put that up. Now, but if you go to page 49, it's there for you. Aha, I won. There's a new kind of hardware called paper. You can draw on it. You can do all kinds of graphics. Yeah, you don't lose it when the paper crashes, you know. All right. Now, notice in this, first of all, every line has two I morphemes. Notice, my, me. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you his cry is very personal and he's very self-consumed about himself, right? That's not where you want to be, but that's where David is. So you have to start where you are. That's the first thing you see about his plea. He's really distressed. Next line. Slide. Whoop. Notice, normally in a lament psalm, you address the Lord as you. He can't do that. Notice it's third person, Lord, Lord, him, him. What does that tell you about David's soul? God feels distant to him. He doesn't feel present with him. Next slide. But notice, he does make progress in one verse. We're going from to the Lord. So it's sort of like he's at the bottom of the mountain, God's up the mountain, and he shoots his voice up there. But by the time he's at the second verse, at least he's at the door, and he's knocking on the door before him. You're being attentive to detail. This is good. It's all you're doing. Be attentive. Because what I want you to see in these Psalms are not flat prayers, petitions. They are dynamic. Every single line moves the soul to another place. So you want to watch for the changes. Next slide. Now, if you look at the verbs and how the verbs progress, to cry aloud and to pour out is just like you're venting your emotions. And the verb pour out comes from Hannah. David learned to do this from Hannah when Hannah was distressed and she's pouring out her soul before the Lord, and Eli, this fat Jubba the Hutt priest, thinks she's drunk because he's never seen a woman pray before. You know, his sons are off sleeping with all the women. He's getting fat on all the offerings. He's a typical American pastor. And Hannah's there, and she's rebuked as being not just drunk, but an alcoholic. And she says, excuse me, sir, I am pouring out my soul, which means you're spending it all. You're not holding back any emotion. You're spending it. But notice, the verbs in the first line of the verses are sort of inarticulate venting. Cry aloud is a cry under oppression, and then you're pouring it out. The second word, you're becoming articulate. Appeal for grace. Declare. So what we find is David's voice becomes more articulate, and his passions become more acute as he's connecting with God. All of that in two verses. Next slide. Okay, so I think that's all these. Now we come to his lament. Now here's where you want to look at your page 49, where I put an exercise in. So what's the stress? What's he articulating? Well, notice how this is carefully structured. You have two poetic lines, a tricolon, three lines. In the middle is an imperative with two, right, look to the right and see, a double imperative, followed by three lines. So see how balanced it is? The more pain you're in, the more structure you need. Any counselor will tell you that. When you're depressed, I remember after my son died, I needed such basic structure to put one foot in front of the other, because you feel like you're swallowed in a tidal wave, you can't breathe, there's no bearings, and you need structure. So the more pain David's in, the more structured is his poetry to give his soul a way to move. That's why good music is very key to healing. Like, who was it that had, was it you, the psalm? Who shared the psalm about the lament psalm? It was you. And you shared, you went over it and over it and over it, and that psalm gave you structure to move. And that's what David has here. So look at his tension. So if you look at the book, A, on 49, God's sovereign and knows David's path, right? That's your theology. But every path seems a dead end with no escape. So how do you put that together? Number two, B, God has a legal obligation to protect his chosen king. David is supposed to have a right-hand man of protection like Jonathan, yet David finds himself in a cave, Adullam, completely alone. Is God blind? Look to the right and see. Hello? Is nobody here? Did you know you had permission to do this in prayer? Number three, C, the king is supposed to be the center of Israel's worship. When all come to him for justice and offer prayers that God bless him and further his dominion among the nation, yet for David, no one even regards him. And here's the nadir of the poem. See this? No one, no one, no one, no one. That's the darkness of his poem. So your exercise, consider a time in your life when you experience a similar tension in reality, didn't seem to go to correspond to God's promises. Perhaps you prayed and you went down a road and it was a dead end. Sometimes that's a job. Sometimes that's a marriage. You prayed, you got married with your eyes open. I have a friend, she got married, and she went through some sexual abuse by a high school coach who took advantage of her when she was in high school. So she's had that pain. Then she marries. She doesn't know the guy she's marrying is an alcoholic and a drug addiction guy who's been clean for a while but had been on cocaine. And goes to the marriage with that. She says, God, how could you do that? That's tension. Other times you feel abandoned or rejected by others. I've been rejected by my father, and then I had it replayed with one of my spiritual fathers, which was like it was a total replay. And I'm looking at this, and I'm going, this is not about, this is about fathers and sons. And so that's what he articulates here. Then notice, not only does he articulate the tension, he articulates doubt. So on next page. If David's situation continues unchanged, it would call into question God's sovereignty, you knew my path, his faithfulness, look to the right and see, and his compassion, no one cares. So rather than living with these doubts and blindly going on, David voices the dilemma to God, leaving the responsibility with God to resolve the tension. So here's the freedom you have. You don't have to solve that tension. God has to solve that tension. So that is critical in growing in your faith. You don't have to compromise the... So you put those tensions out there that you know to be true. You were sovereign. You're faithful. You're compassionate, and it doesn't fit at the moment. Then, not only does he do that, he articulates the emotions of how that makes him feel. How it makes him seem to him. So three emotions emerge. He feels worthless. No one regards me. He feels abandoned. No one cares for me. And he feels hopeless. There's no escape for me. And so what I'd have you do in your poem, if this is, fits with you, you articulate the emotions that you feel honestly. And that's proper to do in worship. Yeah. Probably both. I was trying to look for terms that fit, and there may be better ones there in that ABC on that outline. No one regards me. Yeah, I kind of like worthless. I mean, if no one pays attention to me, you feel like a zero. You know. It's interesting. I had my mom was dying, and. So I asked my two daughters in San Diego, they were going to school, would you come up and see mom? And so my two daughters, Jenny and Katie, were in college. They had never been at the Morgan family home dinner where everyone was present to see the Morgan family dynamics. Well, here my dad's 90 and we're still like little kids, like Jacob and Esau, and working. Everybody wants my dad's blessing. And so my sister's there with her husband and my other sisters, and so... My one sister's so strong and dominant, she talks 95% of all conversations. She asks you a question, she answers, and she controls all the conversations. She even speaks for my dad, makes his mouth go up and down. And then my other sister, the older one, says, I'm not even sitting at the table. I'm going to sit over here in the other room and just eat by myself. And then the youngest one, who was the rebel and came back, and she did all these good deeds, but nobody's noticing. She's kind of crying. And my dad's just clueless. He's just eating his dinner. He's 90 years old. What does he know? And then I'm thinking, what do I have at this table? I says, I got something nobody's got. I got daughters. So I'm proud. I don't have to say anything. I'm sitting there next to Katie and Jenny, and the dinner goes on. So after dinner, my oldest sister, the one who controls, she comes up to me. She says, you know what Dad said? He said, who are those two beautiful girls over there? See, he doesn't even know who your daughters are. Now, he was had a little dementia, and that was true, but what she was saying, where the arrow went deep, is, yeah, he never did know my daughters. They were a zero. Never came into their world. And she knew how to throw that at me. You know, sibling rivalry never ends, right? And I don't even know if she did it consciously, but boy, did I feel it, you know, and just worthless. You know, you don't have a voice in your own home. So that's how David feels. Now, I guess I can use this. Are you back on mine? Oh, you're amazing back there. You know, you leave a tech guy alone, you don't bug him, things happen. I've learned that if I got advice that just screws things up, but if I just leave these guys alone, just look at this. I bet you got the Hebrew back too. No. Okay. Now notice now David has done two things in this poem. He's cried out and he's lamented. Now he's going to cry out again. This is the same verb as the earlier one. But because he's lamented, he has a new insight that comes into the cry that makes it new. So don't ever think, again, it's pure repetition. It's never pure repetition. It's always being made new. So look carefully at this. Okay, Scott Sims, read that.
I cry aloud to you, O Lord. I say you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my ringing cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from those pursuing me, for they are stronger than me.
This is not rocket science, is it? But notice what happens. I cry aloud to you. Now notice, it's no longer the Lord. It's no longer him. What is it? So what's happened? He feels God's presence. Something happened in articulating that lament that brought heaven to earth, and he feels like God is close. Isn't that neat? From where he started, me, I, abandoned. Now, ooh, you. Then this makes him say, you are my refuge. That's Psalm 2. How blessed are all who take refuge in you. Psalm 1 and 2 are like the theological linchpins that drive the Psalter. So, you're my refuge. And he feels this buoyant trust having just lamented. I don't know how that happens, but it happens. If you don't allow people to be honest, you won't help them in their faith. But when you allow people the privilege of being honest, all of a sudden they go, "But God's good." You know, where'd that come from? Something happened, goes from the head to the heart through honesty. Now, my portion in the land of the living, this is what's new, and you need a concordance to figure that out. The word portion was really the... Everybody in Israel had inheritance. Every tribe had land. And this is the word for that, inheritance. Every tribe had land except one. What was that?
Levi.
What was their inheritance? The Lord. David's homeless. He has no land. But what is his inheritance now? The Lord. He's become a priest. He feels this intimacy that only the priests are supposed to have. And this happens in a new way. You go, well, that's new. So his cry is the same cry of oppression, but it has confidence in it. That the Lord's present and the Lord is all he needs. He doesn't need any land. Now, notice the second one. Give heed to my ringing cry. That's the word ranan, which is kind of a stadium shout. It's a more intense cry than the first cry. For I am brought very low. So just because you feel like the Lord is present does not mean you feel adequate to face the enemy. That neat? So he has to pray again. So just because the Lord's with you doesn't mean you ever feel adequate. Inadequacy is something we feel till we die, but it makes us trust God. So he prays again, the enemies are just stronger than me and I need you to deliver me. So that's his second cry, but now it's infused with confidence. Now, here comes the best thing. Okay. Sang. Read the verse. Stand up and read it so you can see it. Can you see it?
Bring my soul out of prison, that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, and you will deal counsel
for me. Okay, so now all of this has prepared him to bring to his specific petition. It's just one line. Bring my soul out of prison. The cave is like a prison. And the bring me out is the same verb used in the Exodus when God brought Israel out of Egypt. They were in slavery. I'm in that situation right now. And then why does he want to get out of prison? So he can do what? Pay his vows. There's the vow. So I can give thanks to your name. And then he envisions what that will be like. And as he does it, he realizes the righteous will be surrounding him. And the word surround is actually almost... king him with a turban on his head. So they'll just be, what God does with his messianic king affects the whole nation. And he doesn't say because I'm going to survive. He says because you deal bountifully with me. He realizes he's going to triumph in a way that's way beyond survival. Now, as he's getting here, you realize he is living in the future before it happens. So the lament psalm put him in a place where he's tasting the future before the future comes in history. And that's the beautiful thing about poetry. Do you know what eternal life means? It's a lousy expression. Eternal life doesn't mean living forever. Eternal life is the life of the age to come. New heavens, new earth, the places that's so rich you put your donkey up to the vine because you don't care if he eats the grapes of Pinot Noir because the place is so lush. The place is so lush you can't get the grapes off of the harvest before the plowman comes because they're so heavy and dense. The place is so fertile and the rivers. It's the life of that age. By the Holy Spirit, into your dead body now, you're experiencing in the present. So the church is actually the people of the future, living the life of the resurrection now in this decaying age. And he's experiencing that through his psalm. Now, if you go back and say, well, what actually happened? Well, we know the story. He prays in his cave, and he's alone. He looks out the cave, and here comes 400 men. It's a new definition for the righteous. The distressed, those who are in debt and bitter of soul, those are the righteous. They surround him and he becomes captain. Think how he felt praying this prayer, tasting it, and then being surrounded by these guys as he looks out the cave. Incredible. Now, let me go back. So now you've done that poem for David. But you haven't done it all together. So then you say, well, how did this shape the life of Christ? And you think, when would Christ have prayed this prayer? When would he have prayed, no one regards me, there's no escape remains for me, no one cares for my soul? When would Jesus have prayed that? Yeah. Yeah, Gethsemane. He didn't have, his all three right-hand men are asleep. He has no advocate. He's alone with God, and he feels abandoned. And now this psalm takes on more meaning. As you play it through the lips of Jesus, you see it at Gethsemane. And in his life, you know, he's born in a cave, and the righteous come to that cave, and he has his ragtag group of guys. But ultimately, God doesn't spare him from death. He's spared through death so that finally the righteous surround him at the resurrection. And why he had to have his resurrection appearances was to pay his vows, and the whole world starts rejoicing and resounding in praise. So that's Jesus. Well, then you got to apply it in your own life. My story is in the book. You can read my father-son relationships, how he came to Christ, me looking at him at his deathbed. That's all written. You can read that. So, Sang, come on up here.
Yeah.
Sang. Okay, we've got a few minutes. So, I'll give you a little quick background while he's gathering his thoughts. His father was born in Vietnam, and during the Vietnam War, he saved a general's life. So, the general gave him his wish, which was, I want to live in America. So, Sang's dad came to America. Seven kids?
Eight.
Eight. Seven plus you. He's the youngest. This is Joseph. And his father has hated him his whole life. Never said a word to him. And it's a Buddhist home. And Sang experienced, he had one best friend, 13 years old, and he was murdered. And a lot of pain. And then he came to Christ and
I think you told my story for me.
No, I'm just summarizing. So I'm setting the stage. So you go from there, and then Sing has a poem, his Adullam poem. Bye.
So I guess what I'll do is I'll give you a couple snapshots of my life and how that shaped me. So I won't keep you too long. Like Brian said, I am the youngest of eight. And I was actually born in California. I was born 5 years after my parents got to the United States. And growing up, we grew up in a very low-income area. So there was a lot of, you know, crime and just some of that stuff that associates with low-income neighborhoods. And the town I lived in was very small. It was maybe about 2,000 people. But growing up, it's one of those things where as a kid, you think that you're kind of Superman. Nothing, you see everything around you, but you don't think it affects you. I grew up watching people get beat up, stabbed, shot at. But it kind of doesn't hit home until it actually hits home. My best friend growing up, Jacob, we were neighbors, we grew up together. One day, one of our friends decided to shoot him.
Excuse me?
One day, one of our other friends decided that he was just going to shoot him. Shot him from behind the head, from 4 feet away, point blank. And he died that night. I was 15 years old. He was 13. It's one of those times where you don't know what to do. You don't know what to think. I remember when that happened, and due to the relationship I have with my family, we never talked about it. I never dealt with it. As a 15-year-old, you're kind of left to discover life on your own. A little bit of background with my relationship with my family is, being the youngest, for some reason, my dad never spoke to me. Part of me wonders if he was just done by the time I came around, especially being somebody who fought in the war. Other times, I wonder if he was just the way he was. And my mom was pretty emotionally abusive with me. Every day I grew up, it was either getting beat by my dad or hearing from my mom that I was worthless, I was never going to amount to anything. So, all that stuff happened before the age of 12, or with my parents at the age of 12, as well as being, kind of weird to talk about, but being sexually abused by a family member, a cousin. Weird childhood. But when my friend was murdered, I didn't know what to do. I didn't, I lived in an area where I felt like there was no way out. And what I did do in high school was I played sports, I played basketball, and we had a group on campus called Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And I got invited to that group by a teammate of mine. And the thing I noticed with that group was that it was a place where I could relax. I didn't have to worry about fighting or running or any of that sort. People were just genuinely nice. They kind of left me alone. So it just became a place of escape. And, through time, I think the Lord just found me. I don't remember a day where I sat down and had my quote-unquote conversion, but I just, through time. So fast forward a little bit, I end up going to UC Davis against my parents' wishes. They wanted me to go to a school closer to home, but as soon as I left the house, I was on my own, paid my way through school. Remember my parents would call, or my mom would call, my dad never called, and she would just yell at me and then for about 10, 15 minutes and hang up. That lasted for about 4 or 5 years. Went through school, I sucked at school, I barely passed, and only because one of the counselors at my college felt like he wanted to help me out. And through school was a great experience for me because I got to discover life on my own. I did get into the local church there, and started working with the junior high ministry. And the more involved I got into the junior high ministry there, and I became an intern and then an interim director there, I realized I had expectations going into working in the church. Because you think working with a bunch of Christian people would be kind of neat or cool. But I learned real quick that they're just as broken as anybody else. But I wasn't ready for that. And from my perspective, I felt like it failed, just like my family failed. And the reason it failed is because the senior pastor and the worship pastor had a huge political fight. And the reason it affected me so much was because both their sons were in my small groups, and I watched how it affected them. And I would remember getting calls at 4:35 in the morning to come get them. And I had a relationship with their parents where I could do that. But, you know, that's beside the point. Kind of moving along here. So I ended up in the Bay Area through a friend who was got me an internship out there with another church because I wanted a fresh start. And 3 weeks into it, he got fired. I got fired because I was associated with him. And I decided to take a year and walk with him and his family through the situation that was going on. But that was a pretty low point in my life. You know, I had no family. Two church bodies failed. And I was done. It's about 2005. And I actually remember sitting down and writing my letter out. I was ready to take my life. And then kind of a funny thing is my computer crashed. And then a week later, I met Brian. And I don't even remember the story anymore. But through a 9-month period, I started going to Brian's Wednesday morning classes, and then I ended up telling Brian everything one morning. I think it was after one of the court cases. Save the details. It was a funny year in 2006 because I met Brian. And then I ended up moving into Kenny's house, which I didn't even know Kenny. I quit my job at a title company because a couple months before that, my brother asked me if I wanted a job there. Me and my brother hate each other. I thought it was bizarre that he had called and said, asked me if I wanted a job with him. So I thought maybe this was an opportunity to reconcile. Well, 4 days into the job, I realized half the things I was doing was illegal and I could be going to jail. So I quit with Brian's advice and walked out. So I had no job and I ended up at Kenny's. And then within a week of losing my job or quitting, I get a job at HP in the engineering department after I told them I have no experience with computers. It worked. I'm still at HP. I worked in the engineering department for 5 years, and now I'm in marketing. But I think through that process, I found a family. And it was a family that I wasn't looking for nor wanted at the time. And it was one of those things that kind of found me when I didn't want it. So that's the short end of it. So this is a poem I wrote. I don't remember when I wrote it. It's on page 51. So I titled this poem called Family, or this word family. So here it goes. Family, a simple word, a simple concept. A mother and father, sons and daughters, brothers and sisters. This word family, what a precious word. but reality invokes a flood of emotions, few that are pleasant, few that are joyful. Each memory chips away at my soul until there is nothing left. The longings of my heart were to be loved as a son, but to be loved as a brother. No one looked into my eyes to penetrate my soul, to let me know I was loved. The walls were being built, each day getting bigger, thicker, stronger. I wandered aimlessly, lost, searching for something, and to what I was searching for is what I didn't want to find. The loneliness and hurt became unbearable. The walls were built, leave me alone. Until one day, like a whirlwind, again, things didn't make sense, but something was different. The walls started to crumble, they started to weaken. What I didn't want to find, I think, just found me. Gazing eyes pierced my soul. They told me they loved me, called me son. The healing started as the tears collided. God spoke deep into my soul. Come home, my son. Enter into the new covenant. This is your family now. This word family, what a precious and wonderful word. I'm done.
You can tell Sang likes emotions when they come up, and that's why he's running away. So I had a very special time with him. We've been to Romania a few times, and actually he never really broke until we were in Romania, and this Romanian kid looked in his eyes and says, tell me your story. And I was over at this other table, and the river was unlocked. 20 some odd years of pain, and we were together this summer walking out under a lamppost late at night and getting to hear our son's longings, and he kind of gave this cry. He says, you know, it's, I really wonder who I am. So, and then he asked that very difficult question, why? The one that never gets answered, the why question. So I said, Sang, the why never gets answered, but I know who you are. You're Joseph. He goes, what? Wow, where's that? So he spent the next couple of days going through the Joseph story, and he came across that phrase that when Joseph is reconciled with Benjamin, they fall on each other's neck and finds a famine. He goes, that phrase, it is enough. And it was kind of a beautiful moment for us together. I love you.
Can I leave now?
You can leave. Just like a son, I get no respect. Okay. All right. All right, Mick, what do we do? Put on the skis and just... Yeah. And just remember, when you fall and you're looking upward, that's the time the lament poetry really works well.